Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price, and I am joined by Chad Bird and Brandon Hansen. How are you guys this fine day?
Hey, we are good. Very good, in fact.
I'm just excited to get started here.
Hey, we're all awake. We've all had coffee. We're all wide-eyed, bushy-tailed, ready to go.
Okay.
That's unusual for us.
It is. It's because we all woke up in great anticipation of what we're going to talk about today.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, I've been dreaming about this for 2 weeks, ready to get into this rather interesting story.
Yeah. I love like a good story about when you get screwed for doing the right thing.
No good deed goes unpunished. One of my favorite phrases.
This is true. Well, all right. Take us there.
Okay. So we're in chapter 39 of Genesis. We are three chapters into the Joseph story. First chapter has him betrayed by his brothers and sold into Egypt. And then we take a detour. We go back to Judah, and we have the whole crazy story of Judah and his daughter-in-law, Tamar, who dresses up as a prostitute, ends up getting impregnated by Judah and has twins, one of whom is in the family tree of our Messiah. So that was chapter 38, quite a colorful detour. But now we're going to turn the car around and go back to Egypt. And we're going to pick up with Mr. Joseph and see what happens to him and this saga that is all about him for the next few chapters. So starting out here at the beginning of 39, we have the narrative described. The setting is depicted for us as to what happens to Joseph after he gets down into Egypt. And at first it sounds like Joseph, I mean, given his circumstances, he is a slave. Yeah, he is in a foreign country. But given how bad the circumstances could have been, things have, at least temporarily, turned out fairly well for him. It says he's taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, who was an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, he bought him from the Ishmaelite traders who had bought him from Joseph's brothers. So the first thing to notice is that he's taken into a household that has some rank to it. This isn't just a nobody that purchases Joseph. This is someone who has some power, some prestige, and no doubt some wealth as well. And then we're told, and this is an important phrase in this chapter, it says the Lord was with Joseph. We'll come back to that in a minute, but that phrase occurs multiple times in the chapter. It sets an underlying theme for the narrative itself. And because the Lord was with Joseph, it says that he became a prosperous or a successful man. And then it goes on to describe how he was prosperous or how he was successful. He was in the house of his master, this Egyptian, and the master saw that the Lord was with Joseph and that the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph is making a very, very good impression upon his master. You know, it's kind of the Midas touch. Everything Joseph touches turns to gold. And the master realizes this. So, of course, he's going to trust Joseph. He's going to give responsibilities to him. And he's going to be grateful that he happened to purchase a servant who has brought so much success to his household. So he finds, it says Joseph finds grace, or he finds favor in the sight of his master. He becomes his personal servant, and it keeps moving up these ranks. He's bought into the house of a man with power, prestige, and wealth. He impresses this guy so much that he makes him his personal servant. And not only that, but finally, he's elevated so that he's overseer of his house. And everything that Potiphar owned, he put Joseph in charge of. And then it's like Moses, as he tells the story. He goes overboard. I mean, he lays it on thick here. He talks about how, you know, God blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessings was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. He left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. It's like Moses can't emphasize this enough. So it's kind of a narrative way of laying it on thick so that we get this very clear impression that things, for Joseph anyway, as well as for his master, were going very well. And it almost, it sets us up and kind of winks at us, because almost every time that you have something like this described, where everything is falling into place, everything is going well, you know what's coming next. It's all going to fall apart. And it's toward the end of this description that we have the hint that something is coming. It says that he didn't concern himself, the master didn't concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. And then we have this description. It says, now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Now, we talked before about how any time that the scriptures give us a description of someone's physical appearance, I guarantee you that is going to become an essential component of the story that follows. Every single time. Because when, of course, today when people write novels, they're giving all sorts of sometimes very verbose descriptions of someone. I mean, by the time they're finished describing Joe or Mary or whoever, you can picture them in your mind. You know what color their hair is, what color their eyes are, whether they're short or tall, fat or skinny, all about their personality. But the scriptures don't proceed that way. They're very conservative in their descriptions of the physicality of a person. So when we're told that Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, we know that's going to become part of the story that follows. And I might add, this is kind of interesting. Joseph, he's kind of the GQ man. He is the only one in the Old Testament, only man in the Old Testament who is described this way. And it's the exact same description that's given of his mother. Same words in Hebrew to describe her as are used now to describe Joseph. So she produced a good-looking kid, really good-looking kid, handsome in form and appearance.
David is described as what, like ruddy?
Yeah.
Like which is supposedly a good thing, right?
Yeah, supposedly a good thing, except the only other person who's described that way is Esau. So it's kind of, it's almost like it, you wonder, is David going to be another Esau, or is this something else? So it's a unique feature of David's appearance, and the fact that he's the youngest son, right? He's the last one, so the last one that you would think would be chosen for being king.
And we know he wasn't overly tall. Like he was like so it wouldn't have been like form and fit. Like he wasn't like this.
Saul. Yeah, I mean Saul was a big guy. You know, if you look at a crowd of people, he was taller than everybody else. So he stood out physically. And, you know, probably when people saw Saul, they thought, wow, yeah, this guy, you know, there's a leader for you, somebody you can literally look up to. But David, on the other hand, somebody you look down on.
This is a huge diversion. Sorry. Now that you said that, I do think that there's this thing about David, which is like, there's nothing, about him that would make you think like, oh yeah, that's the guy. I mean, that's like the whole thing with Samuel choosing David is like, he probably wasn't like all like scarred up and like crazy looking, because then that would be different. But he probably just like as average and normal as a dude can look, which is part of the even like the appearance sort of, you know, prefiguring Christ, right? There's nothing about him that you would assume like, oh, this is the guy. And then he's like, you know, what is largely considered, at least to the Jews, like the greatest king ever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Isaiah 53 says there was nothing about him to attract us.
Right.
If you'd been walking down the streets of Jerusalem and passed Jesus, it's not like he would have turned your head. There was nothing about his appearance that really would have made you think, oh, wow, that guy, he must be something else. Just look at him.
Right. Same.
That's the way that God works. He hides himself under that which seems ordinary or common or even or even not desirable in order that we might live by faith and by what he says in his word instead of by sight.
Yeah, he digs that ordinary.
Yeah.
But how, and even though David's that way, Joseph not that way. So Joseph's a stud. Okay.
Joseph's a stud. Yeah. I mean, he's buff. He's one of those guys, you know, you see these guys and you're like, that dude has got to be a model. You know, he just has that face, that jawline, that physical appearance. You're like, yeah, that guy, you know, he's not going to have any trouble with the girls. Just look at him. Well, that's the kind of guy that Joseph is. He's somebody that the women would notice, and the guys too. They say, man, that's a, you know, he's a good looking guy. Well, yeah, he was a good looking guy. And it turns out the reason we're given this description of Joseph is because somebody definitely noticed him. And that's the way that's like a kind of a segue in the narrative here, because the first six verses describe how awesome everything had gone for Joseph, despite the fact that he was in Egypt as a slave. And then we have this description of him, and then immediately everything begins to fall apart. So verse 7 tells us it came about after these events. Okay, so it's been a while. He's been, you know, he's gained the favor of a Potiphar. He's been elevated up through the ranks of the servants, and now he's the top guy. He's the one in charge of everything. He's the right-hand man of his boss. So it comes about after these things that his master's wife, so Mrs. Potiphar, whatever her name was, we never told her name, looked with desire at Joseph. And she said, lie with me. She just cuts right to the chase, doesn't she?
Yeah.
She's not a woman who, you know, just kind of starts out with casual conversation, and then as time goes on, she adds, you know, a few compliments, and then before you know it, the compliments turn into more flirtatious, suggestive comments, and then finally, with a wink in her eyes, she says, hey, why don't we go someplace alone? No, she's just pretty straightforward. She's brazen. Lie with me, she says. In fact, nowhere else in the whole Old Testament is a woman as just blunt and brazen about a sexual advance as Potiphar's wife is here. And we can speculate as to why. You know, it could very well be because she is in a powerful position. She is the mistress of the household, and she probably expects to be obeyed by her slaves, by her servants. Whatever the reasoning is, that is her wish, her command, her invitation, whatever you want to call it. But it's brief. So what's Joseph going to do? Well, goes on to say, but he refused, and he said to his master's wife. Now, this is kind of interesting because she says, "Lie with me," three words. But Joseph, he delivers a speech in response to her. He says, look. Well, in Hebrew, we usually translate it behold. But behold sounds way too old-fashioned. I like the word look because that's the way we talk in English right now. Look. Yeah. With me here. What's that?
Yeah, no, this is look, girl.
Yeah, right. Yeah, look, girl. Listen up. It's hein or hine in Hebrew, and it really has this idea of it. Look, listen up, look here, look with me here. My master does not concern himself with anything in the house. He's put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I am, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. So how then could I do this great evil and sin against God?
Yeah, and Potiphar's wife is like, challenge accepted.
That's exactly right. Challenge accepted. You know, I find Joseph's response actually pretty intriguing because, of course, he could have said a lot of things. He could have just turned around and walked away. He could have said no and walked away. He could have said a lot of things. Of course, he could have said yes. Don't have to. We don't need to forget that too. He could have said yeah, anytime, any place, right? But his response, I think, is instructive, because it kind of gets you into the mind of Joseph as to why he refuses. He's kind of looking at things in a broader perspective here, and I think it's also interesting because we are encountering a Joseph that is a little more mature than the Joseph that we encountered in the first chapter about him. Of course, he's grown up. He's had some very tough life experiences now, and he perhaps is growing a little bit wiser. So first of all, he says basically, I've been entrusted with a whole lot of stuff, a whole lot of responsibility. I mean, your husband, my master, has put everything that he owns in my charge. I'm not only in charge of the house, but also of other servants. And he hasn't held anything back from me. He trusts me. The only thing he's held back from me is you. That's it. Everything else he's put under my charge and at my disposal. And notice so far, he hasn't said anything about this being a sin. He's just talking about his responsibilities and the trust that's been given to him. It's only at the end, after he said all that, that he actually invokes the name of God. He says, how then could I do this great evil and sin against God? So it's almost like he is looking at things from the whole perspective of the commandments, you know, the second table, which is the commandments that have to do with our relationship with our neighbor, as well as the first table, which has to do with our relationship with God. So he's looking at it in the whole perspective. So this is unique too, because what we've encountered so far in Genesis, you know, if this had been a lot of the other people that we've looked at so far in Genesis, they'd have been like, oh yeah, sounds great to me. Let's do it now, right? I mean, that Judah, I don't think Judah would have said, look, no, this isn't right. Judah sees a prostitute and he's like, how much do you charge? He's ready to go. Joseph, on the other hand, is a little different.
Judah would have been like, okay, but are you supposed to be getting a goat out of this or anything? Is this free?
Yeah. How many goats is this going to take? Or is this a free one for me? Right. But like Dan said, her response was like almost like she relished the challenge, right? She's like, challenge accepted.
I think you have a dual thing going on here. One, a challenge accepted. Okay, like now you've become a conquest.
Yes.
Right. Okay, so like, there's right. There's definitely that. And then there's also like, well, this, and this will play out more. So I think this goes in like phases. This is phase, okay, now it's like the thing that like said no, so I gotta conquer that, right? I'm not gonna accept that. Like now you're my mission.
Mm-hmm.
We will move from you are my mission to hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Like that transition will happen, because once that conquest fails, that's exactly what then we're talking about pride and all that sort of stuff gets in there.
Yeah, this whole story is like a study in psychology in many ways, spiritual psychology, biblical psychology, if you want to think of it that way. I mean, basically, this is like this narrative encapsulates the various ways in which sin morphs itself through, you know, a process of desiring and then eventually persecuting the very object that it once desired.
There's a thin line between love and hate, man.
Oh yeah, yeah. Flip sides of the same coin here. So it's like it's almost as if, okay, she starts out, oh, that, you know, that servant, you know, he's he looks good. I want to have sex with him. And so it just, at least the story portrays it as nothing more than lust to begin with, right? It's just lust, pure and simple. But then once the the lust is rebuffed, then it becomes more of a matter of pride, because she must have him, because his rebuffing of her advances has made it seem as if she's undesirable, and she has to prove to him otherwise. So what does she do? Well, she just bugged him to death. Immediately after his speech, it doesn't say that she responded. She didn't try, you know, some kind of theological argument with him to justify why they could do this. It says, came about after she spoke to Joseph day after day, that he did not listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. Now, there's a subtle difference here. Well, first of all, yeah, this becomes a daily temptation. Day after day, she tries to get him to sleep with her. But there's something else, too. It says at the very end of that verse, he didn't listen to her to lie beside her or be with her. I suspect that what's going on here is that she's saying to herself, okay, this direct approach didn't work with Joseph. So instead, what I can do is just try and get him to spend some time with me, not to have sex with me, just to be with me, just to spend time with me, just to talk with me. Thinking to herself that as she does this, then gradually she'll be able in an indirect way to win him over to her proposal. So if the direct approach doesn't work, then try the indirect approach to it.
Well, there's different kind of makeups of people here, right? So like if she's dealing with most of the people that we've dealt with in Genesis so far, the direct approach probably gets the job done. You just say like, here I am, here you are, let's do that. Mm-hmm. And that probably works with like that, like, well, in reality, that probably works with most dudes.
Yeah, right? Probably.
That probably works. Yeah. However, Joseph is a, you could tell by this like big speech he gives. And I mean, everything we know about Joseph is like, he's a more pensive than that. You know, he's a dreamer, man. Right, so yeah, Joseph's like a different kind of dude, different kind of guy, and so it's like, oh, okay, so like I gotta like worm my way into affections now, like this. It's like this. I can't just appeal to like the manly instinct. I have to appeal to him on another level first before I can like get in there.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what she's doing.
It's a big fat game.
It has become a game to her. Yeah, she's determined. She's determined to win. She's going to use everything at her disposal, and whatever she has to do, that's what she's willing to do. But it wasn't working. this biblical story is like so many biblical stories, because we always wish that we were told a little bit more. You know, we're always wanting a few more details here, because This whole thing could easily be a novel, and yet we have just 23 verses in this chapter that tells us what went down. So she tries, and then she tries, and then she tries still more, and he's not listening to her. Nothing seems to work with Joseph. So it's almost as if she finally gets to the point where she is so frustrated that she kind of returns to her first approach, a very direct approach, because it says that one day that Joseph goes into the house to do his work, and just so happens that that time that he's in the house, that all the other servants are outside, so he alone is there, and she comes up to him. And she grabs him by his outer garment. If they were like most people back then, they had a kind of a two layers of clothing that they wore. So she grabs a hold of his outer garment, and she says, "Lie with me." Same words as she used in the original temptation. And Joseph, left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. So things have come to their climax now. The first time he was able to get away from her with a mere speech. No, this is wrong. Here's why it's wrong. We can't do this. And she backed off. I tried a different approach. That approach didn't work. And so finally, she tries this one last attack. And Joseph has to basically run away from her in order to get outside. And it's here where things get very interesting. Because what might she do? Well, she could simply chalk it up to one more failed attempt and then, you know, try again some other way to get him to accept her advances. Or she could go with option B, which is what she ends up doing. She sees that he's left his garment in her hand and had fled outside. So she completely reverses things. She calls the men of her household and says to them, look, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed. And so it came about when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside. So what's up with her? I mean, why this sudden change? First, she wants to sleep with him, and now she is accusing him of rape, attempted rape.
Yeah, well, I think there's the scorn of rejection, which no one likes that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's got to be a little bit of self-preservation in here too, right? Because, like, I mean, at some point, does she not assume that Joseph might just be like, okay, like, now this got out of hand, like this was like, and I'm gonna go to Potiphar and be like, bro, I don't know how to say this, but your wife is like all over me, and like it's an awkward conversation, but I don't know what to do. And I just think you should know, like, you don't want that conversation happening, and you might have like gone too far, and you think like I've probably pushed him to that conversation. Better if I come up with an accusation first. Like, so it's better. So I'm already now. I'm like, so my pride is hurt, my ego is hurt because this guy didn't want me. I was like really super aggressive. I probably took it to the point where, like, he's probably going to go to my husband the second he can find him. I'm just going to start screaming. That's what I would think is happening, is that you say, like, I'm going to accuse you of trying to rape me before.
You can accuse me of trying to seduce you.
Yes. Right? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So she is taking control of the narrative, right? This is, I know that Joseph might be telling you this, but let me tell you what really happened. And I've got proof to back me up, right? But there's something else that she does too. Notice that she doesn't want to stand alone. And so she tries to get the people around her on her side.
She's like playing the race card, like big time. Like,
yeah.
Like, that's dirty stuff. Like, so now she's like, well, you got to believe me. He is a Hebrew after all. Like, yeah, and you know how they are.
Yeah. And there's a not so subtle accusation against her husband too, because it says, look, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. Notice how she uses the plural us, like she's a servant. Yeah, she's not a servant, but she's trying to build some camaraderie with those who are going to be her, I guess, her witnesses on her behalf. And she accuses her husband at the same time. I'm like, my husband brought in this Hebrew, and he's making sport of us, not of me, but of us. And to top it all off, he just tried to rape me. And the only way that I was spared was by screaming so that he ran away. And I've got proof, because look, I've got his garment. He left it here after I screamed. So she's building the story that she can use against Joseph to protect herself and also to make her ego feel better, because she's been scorned.
I tell you what, Joseph's the one dude in the Old Testament whose garments constantly get him in trouble.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's a great thing to point out. His clothing Yeah, he's always getting him in trouble.
I'm
It
like,
was
I'm
one of the
like,
many colors.
yeah, dude. I'm like wondering, like, did you be like, I need a, you know what? I liked that coat of many colors. I'm gonna get another one of those. Rock that because to remember my dad, you know. See, I just need to remember where I came from. So I'm gonna rock this like super flamboyant thing. And then she yanks it off him and is like, you know who this belongs to, right? And everyone's like,
Yeah.
oh yeah. It's that freaking
Yeah.
dude that's wearing that thing, yeah.
Everybody knows this is Joseph's garment. Yeah. Joseph, he's clueless, I suppose, about all of this. She's not finished yet. She's not finished
I
yet.
mean,
She's.
it does seem that she does this before he can get a, have a chance to even go talk to Potiphar.
Yeah.
Like
Yeah.
she's, I mean, she's been.
He's evidently gone at this point. So she's taking advantage of his absence in order to do everything that she can to build her case so that when he gets back, she's going to be able to say, look, this is what happened. You're going to have to deal with this. So that's what happens next. So she leaves Joseph's shirt or coat or whatever it was beside her until his master came home. And now this is fascinating because any time that you have the repetition of a speech in the Bible, always pay close attention to whether it's an exact repetition or whether some words are changed in the process. Because what you see here is that there are some changes in the speech that she gave to the servants and the speech that she then repeats to her husband. So to her husband, she says, the Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came in to me to make sport of me. Now notice she's changed things around. Now it's no longer to make sport of us, but she's making it personal. Came in to me to make sport of me. Of course, she's talking to her husband, so she's arousing his jealousy and his anger. And then she goes on, and it happened as I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment beside me and fled outside. She leaves out a very important phrase that she used earlier because to the servant, she said, he came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed. But when she's talking to her husband, she says that he came in to make sport of me, and it happened as I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment. So she actually leaves out the part about him attempting to rape her, whatever her reasoning might be. So she's brought the servants onto her side. She's now accused Joseph directly to her husband. And it came about when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, this is what your slave did to me, that his anger burned. Now, what I've wondered about this is who's the master angry at? Because it doesn't say that the master's anger burned against Joseph, although no doubt that was part of what was going on here. But notice that as the story goes on, Joseph is not executed, which seems to me would have been the logical next step for the master to take. I mean, if the guy's a servant, he has absolutely no authority except that which his master's given to him. If he's just tried to rape the master's wife, why in the world would he just put him in prison?
Maybe his wife has played the victim card one too many times.
Maybe she has. Maybe he doesn't quite buy the story that she gives, and this anger that burns within him is not necessarily just against Joseph, but against his wife as well, because of what she has created, the mess that she has created.
You have to wonder, like, depending on how long this was. That how long this from the first advance to this, however long that was, you have to wonder if he was like, if he could tell that
Interested in him, look at him.
looking at Joseph a little too long sometimes. I mean, like, you don't know how much time is taking place here, but like this stuff isn't like incredibly difficult to spot.
No, it's not. I mean, most husbands or wives are able to pick up on these things very quickly. So I suspect that Potiphar was as well. He could tell she was interested in Joseph. So when she comes up with this story, and of course, it doesn't tell us this, but I find it hard to believe that Joseph did not defend himself.
Right. Yeah, surely.
And say, hey, what? No, let me tell you what really happened. And obviously the Potiphar trusts him. I mean, he's elevated him to this superior rank. So he knows that Joseph is a trustworthy person. So once he's heard both sides of the story, there had to have been some suspicion in his mind as to the accuracy of his wife's claims. And maybe that's why he had to do something. I mean, he was accused of attempted rape, so he has to do something. And so instead of executing him, he puts him in prison in the stockade instead. But isn't it fascinating what sin will do when what we want we are not given? This whole story brings home the fact that sin is being curved in upon oneself. She never wanted Joseph for Joseph's sake. It's not as if she wanted to be with him so that she could do something for Joseph. This was all about her. And so when she didn't get what she wanted in this form, she went after what she wanted in another form. So her lust gave way to pride, which then gave way to anger and the desire for revenge. And in all of this, from the lust to the revenge, all of it is nothing more than her self-serving actions, which is what sin does. It's there to gratify what we desire and not to act in love toward the neighbor.
And the harsh reality, I think, of like this text is that she, as far as we can tell, gets away with it, and Joseph ends up in jail.
Yeah, Joseph ends up in jail. Like I said earlier, no good deed goes unpunished. The righteous are often persecuted for doing the right thing, as happens here. But to end on a positive note, which is what the story actually does, it says Joseph's put in prison, but it says the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in sight of the chief jailer. And this is the scripture's way of reminding us that it doesn't matter how much sin seems to have its way with us, or the sins of others seem to have their way with us, that the Lord remains with us. And even though Joseph doesn't realize it at the moment, and even though we often don't realize it at the moment, what God is doing is he is assuring us of his continued presence with us, and he promises us that in one way or another, sooner or later, he is going to redeem this situation and to bring about that which he desires for us. Now, it probably will be bearing a cross for a while, as it was with Joseph. But this whole story from beginning to end shows us what is said at the very conclusion of it, that people intend things for evil, but God intends them for good. So God is able to use the worst, most manipulative, sinful situation in order to bring about good for his children. And this is all kind of a part of that theology of the cross, which is exemplified most clearly in the cross of Christ, where this horrendous act is actually the greatest blessing of God for the salvation of all of us.
And Joseph, obviously, as a type of Christ, there's obviously a lot of connections to be made there about being falsely accused and then punished and all this kind of thing, because that's exactly what Christ does.
Yeah, exactly what happens in him too. Yeah. Yeah, the righteous one suffering for the sake of the unrighteous, but he's doing it all, or God is doing it all through him in order to bring about good for the entire nation in the end. Because it's only if this had not happened to Joseph, then he wouldn't have been in prison, and he wouldn't have met Pharaoh's servants, and he wouldn't have interpreted the dreams, and then eventually ended up at Pharaoh's right hand and saved the entire nation from the famine. So it's an amazing display of not only the providential nature of God's care of us, but his gracious care of us and his ability then to work his good and gracious will despite the sinful motives of those who often place us in situations which God is able to use later on.
Yeah, and we are out of time. That's